Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, August 21st, welcome on in, friends. We've been waiting for you. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And Avi, our brain is our most important muscle. And like any muscle, it needs care and training to stay strong. So today on the show, we're talking about brain health and how to protect our brains as we age. Dementia risk is rising, but research shows nearly half of cases may be preventable. And there's a brand new study out that demonstrates that there are very simple everyday habits that you can put in place that would improve your brain health exponentially. So we have two experts on the show that will help us parse through what really works, what's hype when it comes to brain health, dementia, and all things brain. And hopefully we'll end the show with some practical advice. And we want to hear from you. How do you keep your brain sharp? What questions or concerns do you have around brain health? The number is 888-477-9499. And for our folks watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the live chat. By the way, our email is studio2@whyy.org. You can email us as well.
And you mentioned, I believe, at the top of the show that it's Thursday, correct?
Yes.
Thursday means DJ of the day. So we always end every Thursday show with a song picked by one of you, or sometimes a couple of you, that's related to the topic of the show. So email producer Paige with your picks. Looking for songs about minds, brains, memories, thinking, whatever you want to come up with. You just have to convince producer Paige with an email, studio2@whyy.org. Get those picks in before 12:30.
Yes. Trio of news stories, Avi.
Let's get into it. Let's start with a national story that has huge local implications. Pew Research Center just published a set of new reports that show the American immigrant population is in decline for the first time in, get this, 50 years.
Wow. Yeah.
This is from their analysis of census data, and it could be huge for Philly because our population growth and stability is highly dependent on immigration. This national drop in immigration has taken place since January, according to Pew, when President Trump came back into office. And Pew says this overall drop in the number of American immigrants is at least partially because of a decline in undocumented immigrants. So again, these are national numbers, but they're the first numbers of their kind in half a century. And for us here in Philly, it is absolutely something to watch.
Definitely. So interesting. And in just a few months, the country has seen nearly a half percentage decline in our immigrant population. That's 1.4 million fewer people because of this. And it's a pretty big deal. What also stood out to me is, President Donald Trump was elected because people saw an issue with immigration. And though, according to this report, the country's undocumented population grew from 10.4 million people in 2021 to 14 million people in 2023. That's a huge surge of folks. And so, people saw this as a problem, and that probably catapulted the president into his seat. Also, what stood out to me is that New Jersey is one of six states with more than 500,000 undocumented people living in there. And so living in the state. And so if you think about immigration policies, it's going to have a real impact in New Jersey, real impact in Pennsylvania, real impact in our region.
One more number to keep in mind. The proportion of Americans who are immigrants peaked at about 15.8%. in January, according to Pew. And if you go back and look at history, the last time we got to about that proportion was the turn of the 20th century.
Wow.
And then it plateaued there, and there were huge policy changes that reduced the immigrant population, and then it declined precipitously until the mid-20th century. So there is something, it seems historically, about hitting that 14-15% mark where there's this political and policy backlash. It seems like we're in that moment again, but of course, too early to tell.
Yeah, we'll be watching that. Our second story, the Mutter Museum announced a new policy on how it will handle human remains in its collection. Under the new policy, the museum is employing a more holistic approach. It will continue to show human remains, but instead of focusing on the medical specimen and the condition that it represents, they will now acknowledge the life of the patient.
Mm.
This change comes after 2 years of controversy at the museum. They've had leadership changes. They've had staff departures. And if you recall, the museum first came under fire when its now former executive director removed all the videos and online exhibits in the name of ethical review. People who love the museum literally created a movement called Protect the Muter. And they had a long audit that assessed the museum's 6,500 plus specimens, mostly collected during the 18 and 1900s. And this has been a very popular attraction. Both you and I went to the museum. I've gone several times. It attracts about 100,000 visitors every single year. And people want to see the medical instruments, the specimens. I mean, they had people's tumors on display. Yep. I mean, that's what they kind
of
do.
It's a big part of the appeal.
Yeah, but many of the specimens have been anonymous. And so they had an event last night. They kind of explaining why they're doing all of this. But officials have said that the goal is to name and identify some of the people in the museum's, collection and to humanize the specimens.
And this seems like a thoughtful compromise, right? But WHYY's Alan Yu did a story on this, and he's been following this for a long time. And even though this seems like a thoughtful compromise, it then raises other questions.
Yeah.
Which is, did these people want their stories told? There's no way to know, right? So you de-anonymize and you open up potentially a new problem. So there's no perfect solution here. Like I said, it seems thoughtful. There were a lot of people at the table, and hopefully this, makes everyone feel better about how the museum displays remains, but it still opens up new questions. That's the thorny thing about the past, right?
Yeah.
You'll just never land at something that doesn't have a knock-on effect.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Third story. Really interesting trend piece in the New York Times.
Yeah.
About how more labels and bands are creating music videos for songs that came out a long, long time ago. And the piece starts with the band Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, which emerged out of Philly in the early 2000s. Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah just released a music video for an iconic song of theirs that they first released 20 years ago. And labels have recently released music videos for old LL Cool J songs, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Talking Heads, much, much more. And it all points to a broader trend in the music industry where executives focus more resources on songs that are already beloved, that have like a track record behind them, rather than put that money toward new sounds and artists. So it's cool to see these old songs revived, but then there's also maybe this kind of uncomfortable trend under the surface of it.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because I saw an interview with a 90s rapper on Club Shay Shay. Gotta shout them out.
Okay.
Where this rapper said he has not released any new music in the past decade because he argued you can't make money today on music. And he says, because back in the day, if you sold 1 million albums, you made $10 million. Now, if you get 1 million streams, you get 4 cents a stream, you can only make like $4,000. So videos cost money, right? So if he's making more money on old songs, why not just, put that, take that money and revive those old songs where you can make, more money. And so nowadays it doesn't make sense to make a video off of a new song unless that new song is a hit or a bop and gets millions of views on YouTube or something.
Totally. And like from a risk assessment perspective, if you're a business executive, this makes total sense. Like I can look at this song by Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, or LL Cool J, whatever.
It's making money.
Like, we know people like this song.
Mm-hmm.
There is no music video. If we put it out, people will click on it. And that will revive interest or sustain interest in the band, in the act, if that's what the people want. And so it's so much more satisfying. It's so much more projectable to be like, I can tap into this resource that I know people want or this thing people want, as opposed to taking a risk on a new thing. Now, there is a positive side of this, which is that these songs might not have been able to reach the more visually, I want to put this in a nice way, the folks on TikTok and Instagram who really like to see things might not have had exposure.
New audiences.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. To this type of music because no music video existed. And so it is a bridge, right, between older songs and newer generations. And another interesting facet of all this is that a lot of times these songs get revived because there already is some interest in the music bubbling on TikTok
yeah.
or Instagram. And so the executives see that and they're like, well, let's put a visual to it so we can, like, you know, amplify that interest.
And shout out to the folks who getting this new life in their music. Man,
totally.
It's pretty cool.
This, by
pretty
the way, cool. is the song we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier from Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. It's called The Skin of My Yellow Country Teeth. Big hit 20 years ago, and now you can watch the music video. Today,
yeah,
we'll talk about how to keep your brain sharp. And actually, by the way, one of the methods is playing games potentially on your phone.
Yeah.
Using technology.
Cool. I've been already doing it. But there you go.
So give us a call about how you keep your brain sharp and your questions about brain health. 888-477-9499 is the number. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. New research predicts that by 2060, about 1 million Americans each year will develop dementia. That's double the current rate, and there are frustratingly few clues about how we might curb those numbers and help people stave off cognitive decline.
But luckily, there are some clues. Recent studies point in predictable directions like exercise and diet. Other data is more surprising, including revelations on how vaccines could play a role. So today on the show, we'll discuss the latest developments in brain research and aging.
With us are two great guests. Pam Bellick is health and science reporter for the New York Times. Pam, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Let's also welcome back to the program Dr. Daniel Monti, founding director of the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health at Jefferson Health and author of Brain Weaver, Creating the Fabric for a Healthy Mind Through Integrative Medicine. Dr. Monti, nice to see you.
Always a pleasure to be here with you.
Yes, and we invite our listeners at home, on the road, online, and elsewhere to chime in. How do you keep your brain sharp? And what questions or concerns do you have about brain health? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop those comments in the live chat. And so, Daniel, we wanted to start with you and sort of lay a foundation for our conversation. Can you do a brief walkthrough for us through the life of the human brain? And I'm trying to understand how our brains work and sort of change as we age.
So the brain is an organ of the body, and it changes and ages just like every other organ of the body. And, you know, that used to be more dismal than I think it is now with some of the research that's come out and great articles about that research like Pam has written, where we know there are things that we can be doing to slow that aging process and actually make a big impact on the outcomes. You know, when I was in medical school, the thinking was, all right, once you reach development, then the brain cells start to die off each year, and decline is inevitable, and there's nothing you can do about it, and the brain will decline as you age. We now know that there's much more to the story. It's much more nuanced than that. And just like all of the organs in our body, sure, the aging process will occur, but it can be slowed. How it ages can be dramatically affected by what we do, some of the things that are really in our control.
Let's talk about some of those things, Pam, because they were studied. This is a big new study, this U.S. Pointer study that just came out. The results, at least, were released. And there's been a lot of talk about it. So first, Pam, if you could walk us through what they studied and what they found and why there seems to be such broad interest in this particular study.
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, there's a tremendous amount of interest, understandably, in what we can do to keep our brain healthy and to try to, you know, delay dementia and cognitive decline. It's crucial, right? And every one of us knows somebody who has gone through this kind of thing. So people are really concerned about it. Understandably. This study, the U.S. Pointer study, it's not the first study to look at things that you can do in your daily life to help, but it's the biggest randomized study. So it's a randomized control study, which is the gold standard of science. And it's the biggest one ever in the world. And it was done in the United States. And importantly, it had a very diverse population who participated. And that, unfortunately, has not been true with a lot of dementia studies. So they really got a pretty good cross-section of people, you know, across America to participate. And what they did is they divided, there was about 2,000 people, 2,100, I think, they divided them in half. Half of them got this really, really intensive intervention over a couple of years, where they basically got sort of a recipe of how to do things to that they thought might protect their brain health, like they had to do something like 4 aerobic exercise classes a week, and they had to do 3 cognitive brain training sessions a week, and they were prescribed a healthy diet that is kind of like the Mediterranean diet, and they were given things to do to socialize and to, you know, try to stimulate themselves, try to stimulate their social activity.
It's like the full suite of potential interventions here. And then the other group, what did they receive?
They didn't get nothing, because that was sort of a conscious decision on the part of the researchers. And it also limits, like, can we compare it to just the average person doing nothing? No, we can't. But what they did with this other group is they said, these are really good things to do. Here's some ways you can find resources to do them yourself. Go ahead. We encourage you to do them, but we're not going to give you a prescription.
And what did they find? With, like, what was the big takeaway from the study?
Yeah, interestingly, they found that both groups, their cognitive scores improved quite significantly, you know, at the end of the study, and that the group that had the more intense prescription did better, but not a huge amount better. So we don't really know exactly what that means, except that I think the big takeaway is, if you do these things, it's good for your brain. There will be further analysis of the data and all the different things that they collected. And so, you know, maybe in a few months or a year, we'll have more answers, like which part of it was good, and are there differences in, you know, the which participants benefited the most. But we don't really know that yet, but we can sort of take away, you know, look, if you exercise, if you eat a healthy diet, if you do things to stimulate your brain, if you do things to help your mental health, then, you know, this is good for your cognitive health.
Yeah. And Daniel, what do you think the big takeaway is from studies like this when we talk about brain health?
Yeah, one, that there is hope and that you can be proactive, and that being proactive really makes a difference. Because as Pam said, both groups showed some improvement in this study. And we've seen this in other studies where just knowing about some of the health promoting behaviors that can make a difference and engaging in some of them leads to better outcomes. And I think that this is really important too for the average person listening and the average person who walks into my office for our brain program or just whatever they're coming in for, that you don't have to be all or nothing. That what we see in a lot of the studies is that you're not perfectly, people aren't perfectly uptaking everything, though some studies show a dose-dependent relationship. The more you do, the better. But that if you do some things, that can have real outcomes. So improving the diet somewhat. I try to meet people where they are and say, okay, let's look at where your diet is and where we want to get it. Because the Mediterranean diet that Pam referred to is the foundation of the diet in most of these studies. There's different variations of it, but it's the foundation. And it's basically a diet that has a lot of plants. It's plant-based. It's not completely vegan, but it's plant-based. And it's anti-inflammatory because it emphasizes things like plentiful omega-3 fats, olive oil, nuts, seeds, those kinds of things. And so all of the components of these programs that have been shown to work, say most of the components of the programs that have been shown to work, do something to affect inflammation and bring down inflammation in the body. Inflammation is one of the mechanisms by which cognitive decline occurs. So a bad diet increases our inflammation. A healthy diet, like a Mediterranean type diet, decreases inflammation. The stress of life increases inflammation, but having stress reduction interventions that we can do in our lives, like in this study, yoga or some of the programs they had, exercise helps to decrease the inflammation in the body. And actually, good social connectedness decreases our stress, which decreases inflammation. So there's a rhyme and reason. There's a mechanism that people are thinking about with these interventions. And one of the thing that weaves them all together is inflammation. It's not the only thing, but oxidative stress, and also using the brain, in terms of the brain games.
Let me read some of the comments we've been getting because we've gotten quite a few of them. Mary from Doylestown says, "Whatever is good for your body is also good for your brain. Besides good exercise," she wants to talk about good fats such as avocados and walnuts. Thanks for that email, Mary. Elizabeth says, "I live about half the year in the States and about half in Jamaica."
Oh, I like
Yeah, I wouldn't mind
that.
that. "I think one of the most helpful things I do is drive on the opposite side of the road in each country. Interestingly, if I'm getting ready to change countries, even if I haven't made a plan yet, I will start going to the wrong side of the car to get in, hitting the lights instead of the turn signals, etc. I think a major change of habitual behavior is good for my brain." Interesting thought from Elizabeth. I guess I am like one thing I'm trying to wrap my head around here, Dr. Monty, is like why this might be surprising to people. Because like on the surface, it seems like things that are good for you are good for you. Like, was it, did you feel like it was the case among your patients or maybe just among the general population that people didn't historically have draw a connection between physical health and mental health? They thought of these as two different things.
I think the disconnect has been even, bigger than that. There, for a long time, really up until relatively recently, there's been a big disconnect between what I eat affecting my overall health outcome, including my health and activity level. Even if the state has been there and the science has been there, when you talk to people, and some of it is we kind of have a healthcare system that was somewhat, paternalistic. You go to the doctor gives you your healthcare versus your health and your wellness has everything to do with what's happening when you're not at the doctor's office. There's been a shift in the way we think about things. And, I talk to very high functioning people today, and, we're looking at their labs, and I'm talking about how what they do in their life is causing these labs. And you see the light bulbs start to go off in their head that it's just something that people often aren't thinking about.
I want to bring you back into the conversation, Bam, because one of the things you've written about was how much people's lives have improved if they make some of these changes. And there were examples of people who were actually able to go back to work just by implementing some of the in older age, just by implementing some of the changes that are talked about. Can you give some examples of just sort of the positive shifts that people have seen when making changes?
Yeah, there was a woman named Phyllis Jones who I spoke with for my most recent story, and she's in the Chicago area, and she had been quite depressed. She was in her early 60s. She had been laid off from her job and had some difficulties with a subsequent job. She was overweight. There's sort of this cascade of things that happen, and I think Dr. Monty was kind of referring to, is that all of these things are interconnected. And yes, you're right, it makes a lot of logical sense, but we are not really primed to think of it that way. We tend to think of to compartmentalize. But she's a prime example of how, she wasn't able to get out of bed because she was so depressed, and she w didn't have the motivation to eat healthily. And so she was in the more intensive part of this study, and for her, it was just eye-opening and transformative on kind of every level. I mean, she was very highly motivated. She made a friend among the study participants who lived nearby, a woman who was 15 years older than her. But they hung out together. They motivated each other. They, did the exercises together. They're still good friends.
Wow.
And so it's sort of an illustration. And then, a few months into the study, with the support of, they had these sort of peer group meetings among the participants in her part of the study. And she said that she had just gained enough kind of confidence from the support of these people that she didn't know before, that she applied for jobs and she got jobs, and she's now, working at a job that sort of is a better fit for her. So I think that, one of the key takeaways that I have from, not only this study, but I think just kind of the research in general, is that motivation is really important, and that these types of things, can be sort of additive. Like you could start small and say, not decide I'm going to run a marathon, right?
Yeah.
But decide I'm going to go and do, one day of vigorous walk a week, and then you're going to feel better and you're going to want to do more. And then as you do more, that's going to make, your emotional health better, and then you might be more motivated to, kind of stick to a healthy diet. And who knows, for everybody it'll play out differently. But I think, thinking of it as though all of these things are interconnected, is a good way to think about it.
Yeah.
Keep those comments coming, by the way. Studio2@whyy.org. Phone lines open 888-477-9499, asking for your brain health tips and questions. A lot of folks, like David on YouTube and Jocelyn, I'm going to read Jocelyn's comment shortly, are talking about like doing things that would build your brain. So Jocelyn said, I learned that if you're always learning, your brain is accessing new areas that decreases chances of dementia. Because, and I bring this up because Dr. Monty, you had talked about these interventions as ways to reduce inflammation. And I'm curious, is that really like that's the main area of treatment here, or is there like a secondary area of reducing inflammation and then trying to build new connections, even as we're like in a more advanced age when, we're not like little toddlers anymore? Like, is that still possible with
It's
older
the
brains?
perfect question. Thank you, because that's why I corrected myself and said most, right? So these lifestyle things are really targeting inflammation. But then the brain activities are doing something else and actually manipulating the neural networks in the brain. And we do functional MRI studies on this, my team and in our brain program, and look at how the brain is doing and how it's talking to itself. And the most recent data shows that some of these activities actually change the neuroconnectivity in the brain, and that's really important. And as I'm thinking about the conversation, the reason that articles like PAMS and shows like this are so important, they're for the people who are experiencing or afraid of cognitive decline, but also family members to know what to do and know how to help people. Because I have like the tale of two grandmothers, if I could indulge that story for just a moment, right? So I have these two grandmothers that I was fortunate enough to know my whole life, and they were very different. So on one hand, I had this grandmother and grandfather from Italy who did everything together. They cooked together, they played cards together, they were inseparable. And then I had these other two grandparents where my grandmother was just autonomous in a different way. They had their different hobbies, and she liked to do things like crossword puzzles and jigsaw puzzles in the winter. And she already was very physically active, line drying clothes and things like that. They had a different personality. Their husbands died, and my grandfather's died very close to the same time. But the outcome of these two ladies' lives was very different. My grandmother from Italy, who did everything with her husband, she was lost when my grandfather died, and she disconnected and wasn't doing anything. And at the time, this is 20 years ago, we don't know what to do. I would know what to do now. I'd be in the kitchen cooking with her if I had to be, right? But that isn't what happened. Everybody thought we'd give her space, right? But her space was probably the worst thing to give her. And at the end of 1 year, the cognitive decline was marked. Whereas the other grandmother, she was sad by the loss of her husband, but she stayed connected to these things that she did because they weren't connected to him. And so she was able to do that more easily, her garden and things like that. Whereas the other grandmother really needed help reconnecting to the world now that he was gone, now that her husband was gone. And so I had one grandmother who did quite well, and the other one who I watched that decline. And I watched that cognitive decline, and we didn't start doing anything till we were like a year into it because everybody thought, oh, give her space, give her space. But she needed less space and more connectivity because we now know that that's critical. And knowing these things that help, because she stopped eating well, she wasn't cooking, all of these things she stopped doing that were giving her space. But actually, now we know that we would approach that differently. And that's why it's so important that these studies are getting done, and so important that people who really know how to describe them in a way that Pam and others do, and us talking about them on shows like this is important, so family members know what to do. Oftentimes in my brain program at Jefferson, family members will come with the person and be like, what do I do to support this person? People want to know.
People want to know. Definitely, I want to read this comment from Frank on YouTube. It said, I would love, love, love to have a sharper brain. I'm going to be 50 on August 23rd, and I wonder,
Oh, happy birthday,
happy birthday
Frank.
coming up. And I wonder, as we age, does our brain age as well? Yeah, that's a good question. And that's what we're talking about today. Melinda on Facebook says, please remember that accessing healthy food for people who are poor is challenging, and healthcare is not a human right in the United States. Yes, we have to push on that healthy food access. Eric from Germantown has been on the line. Eric, we want to bring you onto the show. You're on Studio Two. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hello. I was curious about the PM2.5 particles that are part of the air quality index. I heard recently there was a study of people who had been overblown by wildfire smoke and were having an 18% higher chance of dementia. And so I'm a gardener and I'm out in the air. And I had in the past had the impression that these orange air quality days were more about irritation for asthmatic people. And now when I'm realizing that it could mean, memory loss or brain damage, for people who are breathing the air, I'm just curious on, what precautions I should take and what information is out there about that, and how dangerous is this PM2.5 really? That's my question, I guess. I have a couple other things, a 40 hertz frequency.
We'll get to that, Eric. Eric from Germantown, that's a great question. Dr. Monty, could you weigh in on that? Like, how does air quality affect brain health? And could it lead to more dementia?
Air quality is being increasingly linked to health outcomes across the board, including cognitive health. And when you think about it, these things in the air that are toxins, they're poisonous to many parts of the body, including the brain. And things that are toxic also increase inflammation, but that's not the only mechanism by which they're causing problems. So as we increasingly have environments that people are living in where they're exposed to different types of toxins, whether it be sometimes we hear about the water or the air or other things or additives to foods, we're putting more and more stress on the body and the brain. And air quality, we're going to be hearing more about that.
But of course, we do have to get out. Eric was talking about gardening. Gardening is one of the good
Yeah,
things,
that's
and
a good
exercise is
thing.
one of the good things. So seems like a tricky balance. Pam, you were nodding your head as Eric called. I'm just curious if you want to chime in here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with, what Dr. Monty said. There is growing evidence about the role of air pollution and its effect on cognitive health. But the point that you just made also is an important one, and I think it's an important one actually for almost every one of these interventions, and almost every one of these issues is that, yeah, there's an ideal, right? We would, if we can only be outside in,
Pristine air, yeah.
pristine air, and if we can only, eat an optimal Mediterranean diet, and if we can, but I think this is a very classic area where the perfect can be the enemy of the good. You know, there are a whole bunch of other benefits to being outside, right?
Exactly. Being,
exercise.
Good to keep in mind.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's sort of a balancing act. You know how they tell you, you know, eat in moderation. You know, if you think about these things, like do what you can do, just be mindful of these things.
Yeah, totally. I want you to finish that thought, but we are coming up on a break. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. Keep those calls and comments coming. We're talking about brain health tips and questions. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We've been talking about the most important muscle in the human body, the brain. We've been discussing the many ways you can keep your brain healthy as you age. And let me reintroduce our guests. Pam Bellick is health and science reporter for the New York Times. We also have Jefferson Health's Dr. Daniel Monti, author of the book Brainweaver.
And our phone lines are open for you at home, on the road, or on lunch break. I hope you call in. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And our questions of the day are, how are you keeping your brain sharp? What questions or concerns do you have about brain health? If you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, keep those comments coming in. I want to bring in another caller. We have Mary from Doylestown on the line. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I just wanted to talk about inflammation. I think something that really drives inflammation in our bodies is sugar. And when you think about it, if you have a soda and you drop it on the floor, then you will stick to that later on if you walk on it. And it does the same thing with our vessels, our blood vessels in our bodies. And I think that decreases circulation, and probably that affects our brain. I also think about Ronald Reagan, and he ate jelly beans every single day, and he did have Alzheimer's in the end. I don't know if it's a connection, but I do think our brain health is very dependent on not ramping up inflammation.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Mary from Doylestown. And Dr. Monti, you talked about inflammation. Do you want to share anything extra about sugar? And then I want to talk about dementia a little bit after you talk about that.
Yeah, I think that one thing we know that protects the body and brain is trying to avoid blood sugar spikes. Mm-hmm. So when people get cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, so when you're looking at the hemoglobin A1C, for example, the common indicator of type 2 diabetes, this is really an indicator of how often you've had blood sugar spikes in the previous couple of months prior to the blood test. And those blood sugar spikes then lead to, as I think Mary was alluding to, vessel damage. And, you know, many people feel that is a very important contributor to cognitive decline and perhaps dementia processes as we age. So it is important to avoid those big blood sugar spikes, which the types of diets that have been shown to be helpful are diets that don't have high amounts of processed sugars and big glucose loads or sugar loads at any one time.
Yeah. And Pam, if you could weigh in on dementia, when we talk about dementia, what exactly are we talking about? And what does the data kind of show because studies show that the number of folks with dementia is going to be increasing over the next few years?
Yeah, well, so, you know, dementia is kind of a broad term for, you know, cognitive decline that has reached a certain stage, right? You have certain symptoms of typically memory loss, difficulty focusing, you know, paying attention. You may lose the ability, you know, over time to do certain activities of daily living, all that stuff, right? And Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, but there are other kinds. And most of those, the sort of biggest risk factor is linked to age. So this is a little bit of a good news, bad news situation, right? In this country is that, you know, for various reasons, including huge advances in cardiovascular health and things like that, people are living longer. And of course, you have the baby boom generation, so you have a very large aging population. And so, because they're living longer and they're not, you know, passing away from other things, they are increasing the pool of people who will develop dementia and cognitive decline. So that's why when people talk about there being, you know, a surge of dementia cases going forward, it generally has to do with the fact that we're living longer.
It's demographics. Yeah.
Demographics. For the most part,
we have a lot of just practical questions from listeners, and I want to tick through a few of them quickly if we could. Let's start with Sue in Princeton on line 4. Hey, Sue, you're on Studio 2. What's your question?
Hi, thank you. Great show. So I eat mostly vegan vegetarian diet. I exercise 4 to 5 days a week.
Oh, wow.
I get 6.5 to 8 hours of sleep every night. I do maybe too many puzzles every day. I'm 67 years old. I have not eaten refined sugar for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So my sweetness comes from fruits. And so why is it that I am having problems with short-term and long-term memory? And, you know, I just feel like I've been the model person, but still I'm having problems.
Yeah, that's an important question.
Dr.
And
Monty.
Just sympathize with your frustration. So Dr. Monty, help Sue understand.
Yeah. I mean, Sue, first of all, great. You're the poster child of what people should be doing, and you sound terrific. I'm sorry to hear that you're having these challenges, and it's hard to know exactly why they're going on. But one thing I would do is make sure that I had hormonal levels checked, because there's all of the things that, you know, we try to do to lower inflammation. But sometimes when people have dramatic shifts in circulating sex hormones, like after menopause, they notice some of these things. And there's different ways of approaching that. I'm not saying that's the case with you, but it's one of the things that we work up when someone like you comes into our office for our brain program. We know that hormonal health is very connected to cognitive health. And the other thing that I would say is your diet sounds great, but I would just make sure that you're also getting enough protein in the diet. I think that we sometimes underestimate how important that is. And I know that you are looking at plant sources, and that's fine. But oftentimes people in my practice who have a more vegan lifestyle need to take a protein supplement then, because I really like people to get, you know, at least, I would say a woman of your age, at least, you know, 80 grams of protein a day.
Wow. Let me bring in another caller now. This is Mike from West Philly on line 2. Mike has a question for us. Mike, what's your question? You're on Studio 2.
Hi, I'm an epileptic, and I was just wondering if epilepsy can be connected to dementia. I also play music, and I was just wondering if that can bring down the chances of getting dementia.
Okay, Dr. Monty, connection between epilepsy and dementia, and also music as an intervention. What do we know?
Yeah. Pam might know some of the data better than I do on this. I haven't looked at it recently, but the data that I'm aware of, any sort of a disorder that challenges the brain can increase risks of cognitive decline later on. I think the important thing is that your epilepsy is controlled versus having lots of seizures, which are a stress on the brain and the brain chemistry. I'm guessing that the seizures are, and that you probably have a great neurologist who's helping you to manage that. And so if that's the case, then I would say that the risk is probably not that much higher, although some of the medications, there's emerging data that over time they may have an effect on cognition and cognitive decline, but you can't do anything about that. And so I tell patients who have a true disorder and they read the latest article that says, oh, but there might be this link. It's a risk-benefit, kind of a thing. And that ratio you have to take into account for what you really need. Mm. Now, the great news is that I think playing musical instruments is one of those brain activities that is really terrific and helps to preserve the brain. We've seen MRI studies on this, functional MRI studies, to show when somebody's playing the piano, for example, like it changes not just the neurochemistry, but the neuroconnectivity in the brain. And so that's great. Keep doing it and do the other things that we know are healthful and protective.
Yeah. I had this question from Carrie who asked, is an infrared sauna good for lowering inflammation? And since the issue of inflammation kept coming up with brain health, that's probably why Carrie is asking that question. Any advice, Dr. Carrie? I mean, sorry, Dr. Monty. For
it's,
Carrie.
It sounds like something I bet you Pam has written an article on, the infrared, since it's gotten so popular.
Yeah.
If you can weigh in as well. Yeah.
No, go ahead, Dr. Monty.
My answer is we don't know. I think that the idea of an infrared sauna, people tell me they feel better. They feel good. They have less musculoskeletal inflammation. Patients of mine that get a good one and spend time in it, I don't know if that's just because they actually are relaxing and in the sauna,
right.
Or that the because we don't understand the mechanism so well, but whatever.
Stress
the
reduction,
reason,
yeah.
I'm all for it.
Stress reduction helps, yeah.
That's right.
Well, let me ask, on the topic of technology, Pam, I did want to ask about some of the emerging research on these artificial intelligence chatbots as an outlet for socialization, other ways AI could be implicated in this. I'm sure there's some promise, but also some pitfalls here when it comes to AI and trying to reduce cognitive decline. What's the latest you could tell us there?
Sure. Well, just... first, I just wanted to weigh in on the musician caller because,
yeah,
as a jazz musician myself, I am a huge fan of music as a way to sort of stimulate stress reduction. And I've had couldn't prove anything at all, but I've had this experiences where I've been like really stressed out on deadline. Gone to play a jazz gig, and like with the first tune, I can just feel like my
stress,
brain, like something neurochemicals happen in there. I can just feel it. I don't know what it is exactly, but yes, music on, my friend. So in terms of AI companions, I mean, AI is being used for a lot of things that could end up being helpful for cognitive health, including probably most importantly, sort of research, right?
Yeah.
Being able to analyze data, being able to try to make connections and find new solutions. I think that the area of AI companions, and Dr. Monty, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this too. This is a sort of fledgling area. It's also an area where I think a lot of people see dollar signs. So
yeah,
you have
to be. I was going to ask about snake oil. Like, are there uh-huh. brain games out there that are snake oil? Are there?
Well,
are there
the brain games? Yeah. I mean, brain games have been around a lot longer.
Yeah.
At least a couple of decades, and there's a lot of people working on those. I think the general consensus among experts on brain games is that, if you're not spending a whole lot of money on them, they're great, they're fine, and they can be helpful, and they can stimulate. But I think much of the research has shown that you get very good at doing the thing that the brain game is helping you do, and it's a little less clear, although not impossible, but it's a little less clear how much they translate into sort of improving your daily life.
Like, you're good at the game, but maybe your brain isn't actually changing all that much. You're just used to doing that game well.
It's hard to sort of make that translation, Now, I think they're getting better. I think they're getting better. But interestingly, in the study that we were talking about, in the beginning, one of the things that they found, that was one of the sort of five pillars, was having people play computer brain games. And that was the one that people found the hardest to stick to. And so what does that mean? We don't know exactly, but I think it's certainly not the one part, it's certainly not the only thing that you should be doing. Is that right, Dr. Monty, would you say?
And we have to wrap up. So I want you each to tell us one thing. If you were to give someone advice, the one thing that they should be possibly doing to keep their brain as healthy as possible as we wrap up.
I'm going to use mine to just mention something that we haven't touched on that is very, very important. And that is the effect of loneliness, social isolation, mm-hmm. even depression on cognitive health and cognitive decline. And we know that when people are lonely, that is stressful and it is linked with cognitive decline. And so when you're concerned about family members or people you may know, that's one of the things that's important to address.
Yeah. Well, Pam, we will have to cut it off there just out of time, but I want to thank you both. Pam Bellick, health and science reporter for the New York Times, and Dr. Daniel Monty, founding director of the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health at Jefferson Health and author of Brain Weaver, Creating the Fabric for a Healthy Mind Through Integrative Medicine. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our DJ of the day is Liam. Welcome to My Mind by the High Fives is the selection. He emails, quote, it's just my mind that I'm trying to find. It's just my mind that's one of a kind. And Studio 2 is locked inside my mind. Well, thank you so much, Liam, for being our DJ of the day. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY, I'm Cherry Gray.
And I'm Avi. Talk to you next week.